Estimates for the number of animal species alive at the end of the Permian range from as low as 45,000 to as high as 240,000. If you don't know how many species were alive, you can hardly specify with conviction the proportion that perished. Moreover, we are talking about the death of species, not individuals. For individuals, the death toll could be much higher, in many cases practically total. The species that survived to the next phase of life's lottery almost certainly owe their existence to a few scarred and limping survivors. In between the big kill-offs, there have also been many smaller, less well-known extinction periods. The Hemphillian, Frasnian, Famenian, Rancolabrean, and a dozen or so others, which were not so devastating to total species numbers, but often critically hit certain populations. Grazing animals, including horses, were nearly wiped out in the Hemphillian event about 5 million years ago. Horses declined to a single species, which appears so sporadically in the fossil record as to suggest that for a time it teetered on the brink of oblivion. Imagine a human history without horses, without grazing animals. In nearly every case, for both big extinctions and more modest ones, we have bewilderingly little idea of what the cause was. Even after stripping out the more crackpot notions, there are still more theories for what caused the extinction events than there have been events. At least 24 potential culprits have been identified as causes or prime contributors. Global warming, global cooling, changing sea levels, oxygen depletion of the seas, a condition known as anoxia, epidemics, giant leaks of methane gas from the sea floor, meteor and comet impacts, runaway hurricanes of a type known as hypercanes, huge volcanic upwellings, catastrophic solar flares. This last is a particularly intriguing possibility. Nobody knows how big solar flares can get, because we've only been watching them since the beginning of the space age, but the sun is a mighty engine, and its storms are commensurately enormous. A typical solar flare, something we wouldn't even notice on Earth, will release the energy equivalent of 1 billion hydrogen bombs, and fling into space 100 billion tons or so of murderous, high-energy particles. The magnetosphere and atmosphere between them normally swat these back into space, or steer them safely toward the poles, where they produce the Earth's comely auroras. But it is thought that an unusually big blast, say 100 times the typical flare, could overwhelm our ethereal defences. The light show would be a glorious one, but it would almost certainly kill a very high proportion of all that basked in its glow. Moreover, and rather chillingly, according to Bruce Tsurutani of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, it would leave no trace in history. What all this leaves us with, as one researcher has put it, is tons of conjecture and very little evidence. Cooling seems to be associated with at least three of the big extinction events, the Ordovician, Devonian, and Permian. But beyond that, little is agreed, including whether a particular episode happened swiftly or slowly. Scientists can't agree, for instance, whether the late Devonian extinction, the event that was followed by vertebrates moving onto the land, happened over millions of years or thousands of years, or in one lively day. One of the reasons it is so hard to produce convincing explanations for extinctions is that it is so very hard to exterminate life on a grand scale. As we have seen from the Manson impact, you can receive a ferocious blow and still stage a full, if presumably somewhat wobbly, recovery. So why, out of all the thousands of impacts Earth has endured, was the KT event so singularly devastating? Well, first, it was positively enormous. It struck with the force of 100 million megatons. Such an outburst is not easily imagined, but as James Lawrence Powell has pointed out, if you exploded one Hiroshima-sized bomb for every person alive on Earth today, you would still be about 1 billion bombs short of the size of the KT impact. But even that alone may not have been enough to wipe out 70% of Earth's life, dinosaurs included. The KT meteor had the additional advantage, if you're a mammal, that is, that it landed in a shallow sea just 10 meters deep, probably at just the right angle, at a time when oxygen levels were 10% higher than at present, and so the world was more combustible. Above all, the floor of the sea where it landed was made of rock rich in sulphur. The result was an impact that turned an area of sea floor the size of Belgium into aerosols of sulfuric acid. For months afterward, the earth was subjected to rains acid enough to burn skin. In a sense, an even greater question than that of what wiped out 70% of the species that were existing at the time is how did the remaining 30% survive? Why was the event so irremediably devastating to every single dinosaur that existed, while other reptiles, like snakes and crocodiles, passed through unimpeded? So far as we can tell, no species of toad, newt, salamander, or other amphibian went extinct in North America. Why should these delicate creatures have emerged unscathed from such an unparalleled disaster? Asks Tim Flannery in his fascinating Prehistory of America, Eternal Frontier. In the seas it was much the same story. All the ammonites vanished, but their cousins, the nautiloids, who lived similar lifestyles, swam on. Among plankton, some species were practically wiped out, 92% of foraminiferans, for instance, while other organisms like diatoms, designed to a similar plan and living alongside, were comparatively unscathed. These are difficult inconsistencies. As Richard Forte observes, somehow it does not seem satisfying just to call them lucky ones and leave it at that. If, as seems entirely likely, the event was followed by months of dark and choking smoke, then many of the insect survivors become difficult to account for. Some insects, like beetles, Forte notes, could live on wood or other things lying around. But what about those like bees that navigate by sunlight and need pollen? Explaining their survival isn't so easy. Above all, there are the corals. Corals require algae to survive, and algae require sunlight, and both together require steady minimum temperatures. Much publicity has been given in the last few years to corals dying from changes in sea temperature of only a degree or so. If they are that vulnerable to small changes, how did they survive the long impact winter? There are also many hard-to-explain regional variations. Extinctions seem to have been far less severe in the southern hemisphere than the northern. New Zealand, in particular, appears to have come through largely unscathed, even though it had almost no burrowing creatures. Even its vegetation was overwhelmingly spared, and yet the scale of conflagration elsewhere suggests that devastation was global. In short, there is just a great deal we don't know. Some animals absolutely prospered, including, a little surprisingly, the turtles once again. As Flannery notes, the period immediately after the dinosaur extinction could well be known as the Age of Turtles. 16 species survived in North America, and 3 more came into existence soon after. Clearly it helped to be at home in water. The KT impact wiped out almost 90% of land-based species, but only 10% of those living in fresh water. Water obviously offered protection against heat and flame, but also, presumably, provided more sustenance in the lean period that followed. All the land-based animals that survived had a habit of retreating to a safer environment during times of danger, into water or underground, either of which would have provided considerable shelter against the ravages without. Animals that scavenged for a living would also have enjoyed an advantage. Lizards were, and are, largely impervious to the bacteria in rotting carcasses. Indeed, often they are positively drawn to it, and for a long while there were clearly a lot of putrid carcasses about. It is often wrongly stated that only small animals survived the KT event. In fact, among the survivors were crocodiles, which were not just large, but 3 times larger than they are today. But on the whole, it is true, most of the survivors were small and furtive. Indeed, with the world dark and hostile, it was a perfect time to be small, warm-blooded, nocturnal, flexible in diet and cautious by nature, the very qualities that distinguished our mammalian forebears. Had our evolution been more advanced, we would probably have been wiped out. Instead, mammals found themselves in a world to which they were as well suited as anything alive. However, it wasn't as if mammals swarmed forward to fill every niche. Evolution may abhor a vacuum, wrote the paleobiologist Stephen M. Stanley, but it often takes a long time to fill it. For perhaps as many as 10 million years, mammals remained cautiously small. In the early tertiary, if you were the size of a bobcat, you could be king. But once they got going, mammals expanded prodigiously, sometimes to an almost preposterous degree. For a time, there were guinea pigs the size of rhinos, and rhinos the size of a two-story house. Wherever there was a vacancy in the predatory chain, mammals rose, often literally, to fill it. Early members of the raccoon family migrated to South America, discovered a vacancy, and evolved into creatures the size and ferocity of bears. Birds, too, prospered disproportionately. For millions of years, a gigantic, flightless, carnivorous bird called Titanus was possibly the most ferocious creature in North America. Certainly it was the most daunting bird that ever lived. It stood 10 feet high, weighed over 800 pounds, and had a beak that could tear the head off pretty much anything that irked it. Its family survived in formidable fashion for 50 million years, yet until a skeleton was discovered in Florida in 1963, we had no idea that it had ever existed. Which brings us to another reason for our uncertainty about extinctions, the paltriness of the fossil record. We have touched already on the unlikelihood of any set of bones becoming fossilized, but the record is actually worse than you might think. Consider dinosaurs. Museums give the impression that we have a global abundance of dinosaur fossils. In fact, overwhelmingly, museum displays are artificial. The giant Diplodocus that dominates the entrance hall of the Natural History Museum in London, and has delighted and informed generations of visitors, is made of plaster, built in 1903 in Pittsburgh, and presented to the museum by Andrew Carnegie. The entrance hall of the American Museum of Natural History in New York is dominated by an even grander tableau, a skeleton of a large Barosaurus defending her baby from attack by a darting and toothy Allosaurus. It is a wonderfully impressive display. The Barosaurus rises perhaps 30 feet toward the high ceiling, but also entirely fake. Every one of the several hundred bones in the display is a cast. Visit almost any large natural history museum in the world, in Paris, Vienna, Frankfurt, Buenos Aires, Mexico City, and what will greet you are antique models, not ancient bones. The fact is, we don't really know a great deal about the dinosaurs. For the whole of the age of dinosaurs, fewer than 1,000 species have been identified, almost half of them known from a single specimen, which is about a quarter of the number of mammal species alive now. Dinosaurs, bear in mind, ruled the Earth for roughly 3 times as long as mammals have, so either dinosaurs were remarkably unproductive of species, or we have barely scratched the surface, to use an irresistibly apt cliché. For millions of years through the age of dinosaurs, not a single fossil has yet been found. Even for the period of the late Cretaceous, the most studied prehistoric period there is, thanks to our long interest in dinosaurs and their extinction, some 3/4 of all species that lived may yet be undiscovered. Animals bulkier than the Diplodocus, or more forbidding than Tyrannosaurus, may have roamed the Earth in the thousands, and we may never know it. Until very recently, everything known about the dinosaurs of this period came from only about 300 specimens, representing just 16 species. The scantiness of the record led to the widespread belief that dinosaurs were on their way out already when the KT impact occurred. In the late 1980s, a paleontologist from the Milwaukee Public Museum, Peter Sheehan, decided to conduct an experiment. Using 200 volunteers, he made a painstaking census of a well-defined but also well-picked-over area of the famous Hell Creek formation in Montana. Sifting meticulously, the volunteers collected every last tooth and vertebra and chip of bone, everything that had been overlooked by previous diggers. The work took 3 years. When finished, they found that they had more than tripled the global total of dinosaur fossils from the late Cretaceous. The survey established that dinosaurs remained numerous right up to the time of the KT impact. There is no reason to believe that the dinosaurs were dying out gradually during the last 3 million years of the Cretaceous, Sheehan reported. We are so used to the notion of our own inevitability as life's dominant species that it is hard to grasp that we are here only because of timely extraterrestrial bangs and other random flukes. The one thing we have in common with all other living things is that for nearly 4 billion years, our ancestors have managed to slip through a series of closing doors every time we needed them to. Stephen Jay Gould expressed it succinctly in a well-known line. Humans are here today because our particular line never fractured, never once at any of the billion points that could have erased us from history. We started this chapter with 3 points. Life wants to be. Life doesn't always want to be much. Life, from time to time, goes extinct. To this we may add a fourth. Life goes on. And often, as we shall see, it goes on in ways that are decidedly amazing. 23. The Richness of Being. Here and there in the Natural History Museum in London, built into recesses along the underlit corridors or standing between glass cases of minerals and ostrich eggs and a century or so of other productive clutter, are secret doors. At least secret, in the sense that there is nothing about them to attract the visitor's notice. Occasionally you might see someone with the distracted manner and interestingly wilful hair that mark the scholar emerge from one of the doors and hasten down a corridor, probably to disappear through another door a little further on. But this is a relatively rare event. For the most part, the doors stay shut, giving no hint that beyond them exists another, a parallel natural history museum, as vast as, and in many ways more wonderful than, the one the public knows and adores. The Natural History Museum contains some 70 million objects, from every realm of life and every corner of the planet, with another 100,000 or so added to the collection every year. But it is really only behind the scenes that you get a sense of what a treasure house this is. In cupboards and cabinets and long rooms full of close-packed shelves are kept tens of thousands of pickled animals in bottles, millions of insects pinned to squares of card, drawers of shiny mollusks, bones of dinosaurs, skulls of early humans, endless folders of neatly pressed plants. It is a little like wandering through Darwin's brain. The spirit room alone holds 15 miles of shelving, containing jar upon jar of animals preserved in methylated spirit. Back here are specimens collected by Joseph Banks in Australia, Alexander von Humboldt in Amazonia, Darwin on the Beagle Voyage, and much else that is either very rare or historically important, or both. Many people would love to get their hands on these things. A few actually have. In 1954, the museum acquired an outstanding ornithological collection from the estate of a devoted collector named Richard Meinertzhagen, author of Birds of Arabia, among other scholarly works. Meinertzhagen had been a faithful attendee of the museum for years, coming almost daily to take notes for the production of his books and monographs. When the crates arrived, the curators excitedly jimmied them open to see what they had been left, and were surprised, to put it mildly, to discover that a very large number of specimens bore the museum's own labels. Mr. Meinertzhagen, it turned out, had been helping himself to their collections for years. It also explained his habit of wearing a large overcoat, even during warm weather. A few years later, a charming old regular in the mollusks department, quite a distinguished gentleman, I was told, was caught inserting valued seashells into the hollow legs of his Zimmer frame. "I don't suppose there's anything in here that somebody somewhere doesn't covet," Richard Forte said, with a thoughtful air as he gave me a tour of the beguiling world that is the behind-the-scenes part of the museum. We wandered through a confusion of departments where people sat at large tables doing intent, investigative things with arthropods and palm fronds and boxes of yellowed bones. Everywhere there was an air of unhurried thoroughness, of people being engaged in a gigantic endeavour that could never be completed and mustn't be rushed. In 1967, I had read, the museum issued its report on the John Murray expedition, an Indian Ocean survey, 44 years after the expedition had concluded. This is a world where things move at their own pace, including a tiny lift Forte and I shared with a scholarly-looking elderly gentleman with whom Forte chatted genially and familiarly as we proceeded upwards at about the rate that sediments are laid down. When the man departed, Forte said to me, That was a very nice chap named Norman, who had spent 42 years studying one species of plant, St. John's wort. He retired in 1989, but he still comes in every week. "How do you spend 42 years on one species of plant?" I asked. "It's remarkable, isn't it?" Forte agreed. He thought for a moment. "He's very thorough, apparently." The lift door opened to reveal a bricked-over opening. Forte looked confounded. "That's very strange," he said. "That used to be botany back there." He punched a button for another floor, and we found our way at length to botany by means of back staircases and discreet trespass through yet more departments where investigators toiled lovingly over once-living objects. And so it was that I was introduced to Len Ellis and the quiet world of bryophytes. Mosses, to the rest of us. When Emerson poetically noted that mosses favour the north sides of trees, "the moss upon the forest bark was pole star when the night was dark," he really meant lichens, for in the 19th century mosses and lichens weren't distinguished. True mosses aren't actually fussy about where they grow, so they're no good as natural compasses. In fact, mosses aren't actually much good for anything. Perhaps no great group of plants has so few uses, commercial or economic, as the mosses, wrote Henry S. Conard, perhaps just a touch sadly, in How to Know the Mosses and Liverworts, published in 1956 and still to be found on many library shelves as almost the only attempt to popularize the subject. They are, however, prolific. Even with lichens removed, bryophytes is a busy realm, with over 10,000 species contained within some 700 genera. The plump and stately Moss Flora of Britain and Ireland by A.J.E. Smith runs to 700 pages, and Britain and Ireland are by no means outstandingly mossy places. "The tropics are where you find the variety," Len Ellis told me. A quiet, spare man, he has been at the Natural History Museum for 27 years, and curator of the department since 1990. "You can go out into a place like the rainforests of Malaysia and find new varieties with relative ease. I did that myself not long ago. I looked down and there was a species that had never been recorded." "So we don't know how many species are still to be discovered?" "Oh no, no idea." You might not think there would be that many people in the world prepared to devote lifetimes to the study of something so inescapably low-key, but in fact, moss people number in the hundreds, and they feel very strongly about their subject. "Oh yes," Ellis told me, "the meetings can get very lively at times." I asked him for an example of controversy. "Well, here's one inflicted on us by one of your countrymen," he said, smiling lightly, and opened a hefty reference work containing illustrations of mosses, whose most notable characteristic to the uninstructed eye was their uncanny similarity to another. "That," he said, tapping a moss, "used to be one genus, Drepanocladus. Now it's been reorganized into three, Drepanocladus, Wamstorphia, and Hermatoculus." "And did that lead to blows?" I asked, perhaps a touch hopefully. "Well, it made sense. It made perfect sense, but it meant a lot of reordering of collections, and it put all the books out of date for a time, so there was a bit of, you know, grumbling." "Mosses offer mysteries as well," he told me. "One famous case, famous to moss people anyway, involved a retiring type called Hyophila stanfordensis, which was discovered on the campus of Stanford University in California, and later also found growing beside a path in Cornwall, on the southwest tip of England, but has never been encountered anywhere in between. How it came to exist in two such unconnected locations is anybody's guess. It's now known as Hennadiella stanfordensis," Ellis said. "Another revision." We nodded thoughtfully.
"When a new moss is found, it must be compared with all other mosses to make sure that it hasn't been recorded already. Then a formal description must be written, and illustrations prepared, and the result published in a respectable journal. The whole process seldom takes less than 6 months. The 20th century was not a great age for moss taxonomy. Much of the century's work was devoted to untangling the confusions and duplications left behind by the 19th century. That was the golden age of moss collecting. You may recall that Charles Lyell's father was a great moss man. One aptly named Englishman, George Hunt, hunted British mosses so assiduously that he probably contributed to the extinction of several species.
But it is thanks to such efforts that Len Ellis's collection is one of the world's most comprehensive. All 780,000 of his specimens are pressed into large folded sheets of heavy paper, some very old and covered with spidery Victorian script. Some, for all we knew, might have been in the hand of Robert Brown, the great Victorian botanist, unveiler of Brownian motion and the nucleus of cells, who founded and ran the museum's botany department for its first 31 years, until his death in 1858. All the specimens are kept in lustrous old mahogany cabinets, so strikingly fine that I remarked upon them. "Oh, those were Sir Joseph Banks's, from his house in Soho Square," Ellis said casually, as if identifying a recent purchase from IKEA. "He had them built to hold his specimens from the Endeavour voyage." He regarded the cabinets thoughtfully, as if for the first time in a long while. "I don't know how we ended up with them in bryology," he added. This was an amazing disclosure. Joseph Banks was England's greatest botanist, and the Endeavour voyage, that is the one on which Captain Cook charted the 1769 transit of Venus and claimed Australia for the crown, among rather a lot else, was the greatest botanical expedition in history. Banks paid £10,000, about $1 million in today's money, to bring himself and a party of nine others, a naturalist, a secretary, three artists and four servants, on the three-year adventure around the world. Goodness knows what the bluff Captain Cook made of such a velvety and pampered assemblage, but he seems to have liked Banks well enough and could not but admire his talents in botany, a feeling shared by posterity. Never before or since has a botanical party enjoyed greater triumphs. Partly it was because the voyage took in so many new or little-known places. Tierra del Fuego, Tahiti, New Zealand, Australia, New Guinea. But mostly it was because Banks was such an astute and inventive collector. Even when unable to go ashore at Rio de Janeiro because of a quarantine, he sifted through a bale of fodder sent for the ship's livestock and made new discoveries. Nothing, it seems, escaped his notice. Altogether, he brought back 30,000 plant specimens, including 1,400 not seen before, enough to increase by about a quarter the number of known plants in the world. But Banks's grand cash was only part of the total haul in what was an almost absurdly acquisitive age. Plant collecting in the 18th century became a kind of international mania. Glory and wealth alike awaited those who could find new species, and botanists and adventurers went to the most incredible lengths to satisfy the world's craving for horticultural novelty. Thomas Nuttall, the man who named the wisteria after Caspar Wistar, came to America as an uneducated printer, but discovered a passion for plants, and walked halfway across the country and back again, collecting hundreds of growing things never seen before. John Fraser, for whom is named the Fraser Fir, spent years in the wilderness collecting on behalf of Catherine the Great, and emerged at length to find that Russia had a new Tsar who thought he was mad, and refused to honour his contract. Fraser took everything to Chelsea, where he opened a nursery and made a handsome living selling rhododendrons, azaleas, magnolias, Virginia creepers, asters, and other colonial exotica to a delighted English gentry. Huge sums could be made with the right finds. John Lyon, an amateur botanist, spent two hard and dangerous years collecting specimens, but cleared almost $200,000 in today's money for his efforts. Many, however, just did it for the love of botany. Nuttall gave most of what he found to the Liverpool Botanic Gardens. Eventually he became director of Harvard's Botanic Garden, and author of the encyclopedic Genera of North American Plants, which he not only wrote, but also largely typeset. And that was just plants. There was also all the fauna of the New Worlds, kangaroos, kiwis, raccoons, bobcats, mosquitoes, and other curious forms beyond imagining. The volume of life on Earth was seemingly infinite, as Jonathan Swift noted in some famous lines, "So naturalists observe, a flea hath smaller fleas that on him prey, and these have smaller still to bite 'em, and so proceed ad infinitum." All this new information needed to be filed, ordered, and compared with what was known. The world was desperate for a workable system of classification. Fortunately, there was a man in Sweden who stood ready to provide it. His name was Carl Linné, later changed, with permission, to the more aristocratic von Linné, but he is remembered now by the Latinized form Carolus Linnaeus. He was born in 1707 in the village of Roschult in southern Sweden, the son of a poor but ambitious Lutheran curate, and was such a sluggish student that his exasperated father apprenticed him, or, by some accounts, nearly apprenticed him, to a cobbler. Appalled at the prospect of spending a lifetime banging tacks into leather, young Linné begged for another chance, which was granted, and he never thereafter wavered from academic distinction. He studied medicine in Sweden and Holland, though his passion became the natural world. In the early 1730s, still in his 20s, he began to produce catalogues of the world's plant and animal species, using a system of his own devising, and gradually his fame grew. Rarely has a man been more comfortable with his own greatness. He spent much of his leisure time penning long and flattering portraits of himself, declaring that there had never been a greater botanist or zoologist, and that his system of classification was the greatest achievement in the realm of science. Modestly, he suggested that his gravestone should bear the inscription Princeps Botanicorum, Prince of Botanists. It was never wise to question his generous self-assessments. Those who did so were apt to find they had weeds named after them. Linnaeus's other striking quality was an abiding, at times one might say a feverish, preoccupation with sex. He was particularly struck by the similarity between certain bivalves and the female pudenda. To the parts of one species of clam, he gave the names vulva, labia, pubis, anus, and hymen. He grouped plants by the nature of their reproductive organs and endowed them with an arrestingly anthropomorphic amorousness. His descriptions of flowers and their behaviour are full of references to promiscuous intercourse, barren concubines, and the bridal bed. In Spring, he wrote in one oft-quoted passage, "Love comes even to the plants. Males and females hold their nuptials, showing by their sexual organs which are males, which females. The flower's leaves serve as a bridal bed, which the Creator has so gloriously arranged, adorned with such noble bed-curtains, and perfumed with so many soft scents, that the bridegroom with his bride might there celebrate their nuptials with so much the greater solemnity. When the bed has thus been made ready, then is the time for the bridegroom to embrace his beloved bride and surrender himself to her." He named one genus of plants Clitoria. Not surprisingly, many people thought him strange. But his system of classification was irresistible. Before Linnaeus, plants were given names that were expansively descriptive. The common ground cherry was called Physalis anno ramosissime ramis angulosis glabris foliis dentoceratis. Linnaeus lopped it back to Physalis angulata, which name it still uses. The plant world was equally disordered by inconsistencies of naming. A botanist could not be sure if Rosa sylvestris alba cum rubore folio glabro was the same plant that others called Rosa sylvestris inodoro seo canina. Linnaeus solved the puzzlement by calling it simply Rosa canina. To make these excisions useful and agreeable to all required much more than simply being decisive. It required an instinct, a genius, in fact, for spotting the salient qualities of a species. The Linnaean system is so well established that we can hardly imagine an alternative, but before Linnaeus, systems of classification were often highly whimsical. Animals might be categorized by whether they were wild or domesticated, terrestrial or aquatic, large or small, even whether they were thought handsome and noble or of no consequence. Buffon arranged his animals by their utility to man. Anatomical considerations barely came into it. Linnaeus made it his life's work to rectify this deficiency by classifying all that was alive according to its physical attributes. Taxonomy, which is to say the science of classification, has never looked back. It all took time, of course. The first edition of his great Systema Naturae in 1735 was just 14 pages long, but it grew and grew until by the 12th edition, the last that Linnaeus would live to see, it extended to 3 volumes and 2,300 pages. In the end, he named or recorded some 13,000 species of plant and animal. Other works were more comprehensive. John Ray's three-volume Historiae Generalis Plantarum in England, completed a generation earlier, covered no fewer than 18,625 species of plants alone. But what Linnaeus had that no one else could touch were consistency, order, simplicity, and timeliness. Though his work dates from the 1730s, he didn't become widely known in England until the 1760s. Just in time to make Linnaeus a kind of father figure to British naturalists. Nowhere was his system embraced with greater enthusiasm, which is why, for one thing, the Linnaean Society has its home in London and not Stockholm. Linnaeus was not flawless. He made room for mythical beasts and monstrous humans, whose descriptions he gullibly accepted from seamen and other imaginative travellers. Among these were a wild man, Homo ferus, who walked on all fours, and had not yet mastered the art of speech, and Homo caudatus, man with a tail. But then it was, as we should not forget, an altogether more credulous age. Even the great Joseph Banks took a keen and believing interest in a series of reported sightings of mermaids off the Scottish coast at the end of the 18th century. For the most part, however, Linnaeus's lapses were offset by sound and often brilliant taxonomy. Among other accomplishments, he saw that whales belonged with cows, mice, and other common terrestrial animals in the order Quadrupedia, later changed to Mammalia, which no one had done before. In the beginning, Linnaeus intended only to give each plant a genus name and a number, Convolvulus I, Convolvulus II, and so on, but soon realized that that was unsatisfactory and hit on the binomial arrangement that remains at the heart of the system to this day. The intention originally was to use the binomial system for everything. Rocks, minerals, diseases, winds, whatever existed in nature. Not everyone embraced the system warmly. Many were disturbed by its tendency toward indelicacy, which was slightly ironic, as before Linnaeus the common names of many plants and animals had been heartily vulgar. The dandelion was long popularly known as the pisserbed, because of its supposed diuretic properties, and other names in everyday use included mare's fart, naked ladies, twitch ballock, hound's piss, open arse, and bum towel. One or two of these earthy appellations may unwittingly survive in English yet. The maidenhair in maidenhair moss, for instance, does not refer to the hair on the maiden's head. At all events, it had long been felt that the natural sciences would be appreciably dignified by a dose of classical renaming, so there was a certain dismay in discovering that the self-appointed prince of botany had sprinkled his texts with such designations as clitoria, fornicata, and vulva. Over the years, many of these were quietly dropped, though not all. The common slipper limpet still answers on formal occasions to crepidula fornicata, and many other refinements introduced, as the needs of the natural sciences grew more specialized. In particular, the system was bolstered by the gradual introduction of additional hierarchies. Genus, plural genera, and species had been employed by naturalists for over 100 years before Linnaeus, and order, class, and family in their biological senses all come into use in the 1750s and 1760s. But phylum wasn't coined until 1876 by the German Ernst Haeckel, and family and order were treated as interchangeable until early in the 20th century. For a time, zoologists used family where botanists placed order, to the occasional confusion of nearly everyone. To illustrate, humans are in the domain Eukarya, in the kingdom Animalia, in the phylum Chordata, in the subphylum Vertebrata, in the class Mammalia, in the order Primates, in the family Hominidae, in the genus Homo, in the species Sapiens. The convention, I'm informed, is to italicize genus and species names, but not those of higher divisions. Some taxonomists employ further subdivisions, tribe, suborder, infraorder, pavorder, and more. Linnaeus had divided the animal world into 6 categories, mammals, reptiles, birds, fishes, insects, and vermes, or worms, for everything that didn't fit into the first 5. From the outset, it was evident that putting lobsters and shrimp into the same category as worms was unsatisfactory, and various new categories such as mollusca and crustacea were created. Unfortunately, these new classifications were not uniformly applied from nation to nation. In an attempt to re-establish order, the British in 1842 proclaimed a new set of rules called the Strickland-ian Code. But the French saw this as high-handed, and the Société Zoologique countered with its own conflicting code. Meanwhile, the American Ornithological Society, for obscure reasons, decided to use the 1758 edition of Systema Naturae as the basis for all its naming, rather than the 1766 edition used elsewhere, which meant that many American birds spent the 19th century logged in different genera from their avian cousins in Europe. Not until 1902, at an early meeting of the International Congress of Zoology, did naturalists begin at last to show a spirit of compromise and adopt a universal code. Taxonomy is described sometimes as a science and sometimes as an art, but really, it's a battleground. Even today, there is more disorder in the system than most people realize. Take the category of the phylum, the division that describes the basic body plans of all organisms. A few phyla are generally well known, such as mollusks, the home of clams and snails, arthropods, insects and crustaceans, and chordates, us and all other animals with a backbone or proto-backbone, though things then move swiftly in the direction of obscurity. Among the latter we might list Nathostomelida, marine worms, Cnidaria, jellyfish, Medusae, anemones and corals, and the delicate Priapulida, or little penis worms. Familiar or not, these are elemental divisions. Yet there is surprisingly little agreement on how many phyla there are, or ought to be. Most biologists fix the total at about 30, but some opt for a number in the low 20s, while Edward O. Wilson, in The Diversity of Life, puts the number at a surprisingly robust 89. It depends on where you decide to make your divisions, whether you are a lumper or a splitter, as they say in the biological world. At the more workaday level of species, the possibilities for disagreements are even greater. Whether a species of grass should be called Aegilops incurva, Aegilops incurvata, or Aegilops ovata may not be a matter that would stir many non-botanists to passion, but it can be a source of very lively heat in the right quarters. The problem is that there are 5,000 species of grass, and many of them look awfully alike, even to people who know grass. In consequence, some species have been found and named at least 20 times, and there are hardly any, it appears, that haven't been independently identified at least twice. The two-volume Manual of the Grasses of the United States devotes 200 closely typeset pages to sorting out all the synonymies, as the biological world refers to its inadvertent but quite common duplications. And that is just for the grasses of a single country. To deal with disagreements on the global stage, a body known as the International Association for Plant Taxonomy arbitrates on questions of priority and duplication. At intervals, it hands down decrees declaring that Zalshneria californica, a common plant in rock gardens, is to be known henceforth as Epilobium canum, or that Agliothamnion tenuissimum may now be regarded as conspecific with Aglothamnion bisoides, but not with Agliothamnion pseudobisoides. Normally these are small matters of tidying up that attract little notice, but when they touch on beloved garden plants, as they sometimes do, shrieks of outrage inevitably follow. In the late 1980s, the common chrysanthemum was banished, on apparently sound scientific principles, from the genus of the same name and relegated to the comparatively drab and undesirable world of the genus Dendranthema. Chrysanthemum breeders are a proud and numerous lot, and they protested to the real, if improbable-sounding, Committee on Spermatophyta. There are also committees for Pteridophyta, Bryophyta, and Fungi, among others, all reporting to an executive called the Rapporteur Général. This is truly an institution to cherish. Although the rules of nomenclature are supposed to be rigidly applied, botanists are not indifferent to sentiment. And in 1995, the decision was reversed. Similar adjudications have saved petunias, euonymus, and a popular species of amaryllis from demotion, but not many species of geranium, which some years ago were transferred, amid howls, to the genus Pelargonium. The disputes are entertainingly surveyed in Charles Eliot's The Potting Shed Papers. Disputes and reorderings of much the same type can be found in all the other realms of the living, so keeping an overall tally is not nearly as straightforward a matter as you might suppose. In consequence, the rather amazing fact is that we don't have the faintest idea, not even to the nearest order of magnitude, in the words of Edward O. Wilson, of the number of things that live on our planet. Estimates range from 3 million to 200 million. More extraordinary still, according to a report in The Economist, as much as 97% of the world's plant and animal species may still await discovery. Of the organisms that we do know about, more than 99 in 100 are only sketchily described. A scientific name, a handful of specimens in a museum, and a few scraps of description in scientific journals is how Wilson describes the state of our knowledge. In The Diversity of Life, he estimated the number of known species of all types, plants, insects, microbes, algae, everything, at 1.4 million, but added that that was just a guess. Other authorities have put the number of known species slightly higher, at around 1.5 million to 1.8 million. But there is no central registry of these things, so nowhere to check numbers. In short, the remarkable position we find ourselves in is that we don't actually know what we actually know. In principle, you ought to be able to go to experts in each area of specialization, ask how many species there are in their fields, then add the totals. Many people have, in fact, done so. The problem is that seldom do any two come up with matching figures. Some sources put the number of known types of fungi at 70,000, others at 100,000, nearly half as many again. You can find confident assertions that the number of described earthworm species is 4,000, and equally confident assertions that the figure is 12,000. For insects, the numbers run from 750,000 to 950,000 species. These are, you understand, supposedly the known number of species. For plants, the commonly accepted numbers range from 248,000 to 265,000. That may not seem too vast a discrepancy, but it's more than 20 times the number of flowering plants in the whole of North America. Putting things in order is not the easiest of tasks. In the early 1960s, Colin Groves of the Australian National University began a systematic survey of the 250-plus known species of primate. Oftentimes it turned out that the same species had been described more than once, sometimes several times, without any of the discoverers realizing that they were dealing with an animal that was already known to science. It took Groves 4 decades to untangle everything, and that was with a comparatively small group of easily distinguished, generally non-controversial creatures. Goodness knows what the results would be if anyone attempted a similar exercise with the planet's estimated 20,000 types of lichens, 50,000 species of mollusk, or 400,000-plus beetles. What is certain is that there is a great deal of life out there, though the actual quantities are necessarily estimates based on extrapolations, sometimes exceedingly expansive extrapolations. In a well-known exercise in the 1980s, Terry Irwin of the Smithsonian Institution saturated a stand of 19 rainforest trees in Panama with an insecticide fog, then collected everything that fell into his nets from the canopy. Among his haul, actually hauls, since he repeated the experiment seasonally to make sure he caught migrant species, were 1,200 types of beetle. Based on the distribution of beetles elsewhere, the number of other tree species in the forest, the number of forests in the world, the number of other insect types, and so on, up a long chain of variables, he estimated a figure of 30 million species of insects for the entire planet. A figure he later said was too conservative. Others using the same or similar data have come up with figures of 13 million, 80 million, or 100 million insect types, underlying the conclusion that, however carefully arrived at, such figures inevitably owe at least as much to supposition as to science. According to the Wall Street Journal, the world has about 10,000 active taxonomists. Not a great number when you consider how much there is to be recorded, but, the journal adds, because of the cost, about $2,000 per species, and paperwork, only about 15,000 new species of all types are logged per year. It's not a biodiversity crisis, it's a taxonomist crisis, barks Cohen Mess, Belgian-born head of invertebrates at the Kenyan National Museum in Nairobi, whom I met briefly on a visit to the country in the autumn of 2002. Well, there were no specialized taxonomists in the whole of Africa, he told me. There was one in the Ivory Coast, but I think he has retired, he said. It takes 8 to 10 years to train a taxonomist, but none are coming along in Africa. They are the real fossils, Mays added. He himself was to be let go at the end of the year, he said. After 7 years in Kenya, his contract was not being renewed. No funds, Mace explained. Writing in the journal Nature last year, the British biologist G. H. Godfrey noted that there is a chronic lack of prestige and resources for taxonomists everywhere. In consequence, many species are being described poorly in isolated publications with no attempt to relate a new taxon to existing species and classifications. The formal word for a zoological category, such as phylum or genus. The plural is taxa. Moreover, much of taxonomists' time is taken up not with describing new species, but simply with sorting out old ones. Many, according to Godfrey, spend most of their career trying to interpret the work of 19th-century systematicists, deconstructing their often inadequate published descriptions, or scouring the world's museums for type material that is often in very poor condition. Godfrey particularly stresses the absence of attention being paid to the systematizing possibilities of the Internet. The fact is that taxonomy, by and large, is still quaintly wedded to paper. In an attempt to haul things into the modern age, in 2001, Kevin Kelly, co-founder of Wired magazine, launched an enterprise called the All Species Foundation, with the aim of finding every living organism and recording it on a database. The cost of such an exercise has been estimated at anywhere from $2 billion to as much as $50 billion. As of the spring of 2002, the foundation had just $1.2 million in funds and 4 full-time employees. If, as the numbers suggest, we have perhaps 100 million species of insects yet to find, and if our rates of discovery continue at the present pace, we should have a definitive total for insects in a little over 15,000 years. The rest of the animal kingdom may take a little longer. So why do we know as little as we do? There are nearly as many reasons as there are animals left to count, but here are a few of the principal causes. Most living things are small and easily overlooked. In practical terms, this is not always a bad thing. You might not slumber quite so contentedly if you were aware that your mattress is home to perhaps 2 million microscopic mites, which come out in the wee hours to sup on your sebaceous oils and feast on all those lovely, crunchy flakes of skin that you shed as you doze and toss. Your pillow alone may be home to 40,000 of them. To them, your head is just one large, oily bonbon. And don't think a clean pillowcase will make a difference. To something on the scale of bed mites, the weave of the tightest human fabric looks like ship's rigging. Indeed, if your pillow is 6 years old, which is apparently about the average age for a pillow, it has been estimated that one-tenth of its weight will be made up of sloughed skin, living mites, dead mites, and mite dung, to quote the man who did the measuring, Dr. John Maunder of the British Medical Entomology Centre. But at least they are your mites. Think of what you snuggle up with each time you climb into a motel bed. These mites have been with us since time immemorial, but they weren't discovered until 1965. We're actually getting worse at some matters of hygiene. Dr. Maunder believes that the move toward low-temperature washing machine detergents has encouraged bugs to proliferate. As he puts it, if you wash lousy clothing at low temperatures, all you get is cleaner lice. If creatures as intimately associated with us as bed mites escaped our notice until the age of colour television, it's hardly surprising that most of the rest of the small-scale world is barely known to us. Go out into a woods, any woods at all, bend down and scoop up a handful of soil, and you will be holding up to 10 billion bacteria, most of them unknown to science. Your sample will also contain perhaps 1 million plump yeasts, some 200,000 hairy little fungi known as molds, perhaps 10,000 protozoans, of which the most familiar is the amoeba, and assorted rotifers, flatworms, roundworms, and other microscopic creatures known collectively as cryptozoa. A large portion of these will also be unknown. the most comprehensive handbook of microorganisms, Berge's Manual of Systematic Bacteriology, lists about 4,000 types of bacteria. In the 1980s, a pair of Norwegian scientists, Jostein Goksor and Vigdis Torsvig, collected a gram of random soil from a beech forest near their lab in Bergen and carefully analyzed its bacterial content. They found that this single, small sample contained between 4,000 and 5,000 separate bacterial species, more than in the whole of Berge's manual. They then travelled to a coastal location a few miles away, scooped up another gram of earth, and found that it contained 4,000 to 5,000 other species. As Edward O. Wilson observes, if over 9,000 microbial types exist in two pinches of substrate from two localities in Norway, how many more await discovery in other, radically different habitats? Well, according to one estimate, it could be as high as 400 million. We don't look in the right places. In The Diversity of Life, Wilson describes how one botanist spent a few days tramping around 10 hectares of jungle in Borneo and discovered 1,000 new species of flowering plant, more than are found in the whole of North America. The plants weren't hard to find, it's just that no one had looked there before. Goen Mace of the Kenyan National Museum told me that he went to one cloud forest, as mountaintop forests are known in Kenya, and in a half hour of not particularly dedicated-looking, found 4 new species of millipedes, 3 representing new genera, and 1 new species of tree. Big tree, he added, and shaped his arms as if about to dance with a very large partner. Cloud forests are found on the tops of plateaus, and have sometimes been isolated for millions of years. They provide the ideal climate for biology, and they have hardly been studied, he said. Overall, tropical rainforests cover only about 6% of Earth's surface, but harbour more than half of its animal life, and about 2/3 of its flowering plants, and most of this life remains unknown to us because too few researchers spend time in them. Not incidentally, much of this could be quite valuable. At least 99% of flowering plants have never been tested for their medicinal properties. Because they can't flee from predators, plants have had to contrive chemical defences, and so are particularly enriched in intriguing compounds. Even now, nearly a quarter of all prescribed medicines are derived from just 40 plants, with another 16% coming from animals or microbes, so there is a serious risk with every hectare of forest felled of losing medically vital possibilities. Using a method called combinatorial chemistry, chemists can generate 40,000 compounds at a time in labs, but these products are random and not uncommonly useless, whereas any natural molecule would have already passed what The Economist calls the ultimate screening program over 3.5 billion years of evolution. Looking for the unknown isn't simply a matter of travelling to remote or distant places, however. In his book, Life, an Unauthorized Biography, Richard Forte notes how one ancient bacterium was found on the wall of a country pub, where men had urinated for generations. A discovery that would seem to involve rare amounts of luck and devotion, and possibly some other quality not specified. There aren't enough specialists. The stock of things to be found, examined, and recorded very much outruns the supply of scientists available to do it. Take the hardy and little-known organisms known as deloid rotifers. These are microscopic animals that can survive almost anything. When conditions are tough, they curl up into a compact shape, switch off their metabolism, and wait for better times. In this state, you can drop them into boiling water, or freeze them almost to absolute zero, that is the level where even atoms give up, and when this torment has finished and they are returned to a more pleasing environment, they will uncurl and move on, as if nothing has happened. So far, about 500 species have been identified, though other sources say 360, but nobody has any idea, even remotely, how many there may be altogether. For years, almost all that was known about them was thanks to the work of a devoted amateur, a London clerical worker named David Bryce, who studied them in his spare time. They can be found all over the world, but you could have all the deloid rotifer experts in the world to dinner and not have to borrow plates from the neighbours. Even something as important and ubiquitous as fungi, and fungi are both, attracts comparatively little notice. Fungi are everywhere and come in many forms, as mushrooms, moulds, mildews, yeasts, and puffballs, to name but a sampling. And they exist in volumes that most of us little suspect. Gather together all the fungi found in a typical acre of meadow, and you would have 2,500 pounds of the stuff.